Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Events over the past year have shone a light on racial inequality across the globe. Australia is no exception. This nation's journey towards a more just, equitable and reconciled identity still has a long way to go. With that in mind, and in a spirit of reconciliation, we acknowledge the traditional custodians of country throughout Australia and their connections to land, sea and community. We pay our respects to elders past, present and emerging, and extend that respect to all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people today.
I ask the Prime Minister,
how good is Australia?
Please explain.
I'm here to make a public statement.
Australia is back on track.
I actually find it gobsmacking.
Just dumbstruck.
I'm going to shirt front, Mr. Putin.
I want to thank that fellow down under.
I don't think I know.
I have no hesitation.
That should cause great concern.
Just sit down,
Griffith. Stick in your eyes.
You're a classic space invader.
A social climbing sycophant.
He needs a mirror.
I mean...
Oh, fair shake of the sauce bottle, mate.
Taste of democracy, very good.
G'day, Mark Kenny here with Democracy Sausage, which, as you know, comes each week from the Australian National University. I'm myself from the Australian Studies Institute at ANU, and we produce this podcast with the support of the Crawford School of Public Policy, Policy Forum, and with countless others who contribute to it. And it's a great pleasure to bring it to you. And can I just say, it's a little bit of an apology from me for last week. Circumstances beyond our control made it impossible to bring an episode out last week. Although it was somewhat gratifying, just the sheer number of people who got in touch with me via different means to say, where the hell is Democracy Sausage? It reminded me just of the service we provide, and I'm really thankful for people's loyalty and enthusiasm for this podcast, because it means a lot to us too. Now, obviously, this week has been dominated by the federal budget, and I spent yesterday, which also happened to be my birthday, in the federal budget lockup. Been doing that for a long time, as has Peter Martin, who's with us, and I'll come to him in just a moment, because we're going to be talking about the budget, I guess, in general terms, the politics of it, the atmosphere, the macro economic situation that we face in which this budget has been framed. So let's go to that. First, I'll introduce Dr. Jenny Gordon. She's an honorary professor at the Centre for Social Research and Methods here at ANU, and a non-resident fellow at the Lowy Institute. She's got a very storied career as an economist. She's been chief economist at DFAT, and she spent, I think, about a decade, Jenny, at the Productivity Commission as principal advisor and research there.
That's true.
Welcome to you. This is the first time having you on Democracy Sausage. It's been too long.
It's a real pleasure to be here. And yes, I too missed last week's episode. So.
Well, that's good.
Are you a listener?
I am a listener indeed.
That's good. And that other voice that will be familiar to you is Peter Martin. He's the business and economics editor. Is that the correct title?
And economy editor. I don't know why they call it that, The Conversation.
Yes, that's right. And, of course, a former colleague of mine at Fairfax before we were both in the roles that we are in now. And you were economics editor at The Age for a long time.
And economics correspondent for ABC Radio. So I've been in budget lockups for...
You've done more than me.
Somewhere between 3 and 4 decades.
Wow,
I've seen a few.
Yeah, that's sort of about, well, at the outside, that's close to twice as many as me. I think that might have been my 20th, or it could have been 19th. So, yes, it's a particular experience, and it's changed a bit, hasn't it, in the sense that we used to – I mean, I know this is sort of boring inside baseball stuff in a way, but most people won't know what the budget lockup is like, and the idea essentially –
Well, it used to be secret, in fact. You used to not be able to tell people.
It was like Fight Club.
Fight Club, yeah. So that's true because budget measures, and they were beer and cigs.
Yeah, beer and cigs were up always.
The government can hit beer up, cigs up, right? And because people could make money from knowledge of what was inside the budget, the details weren't to be released till 7:30, which, of course, doesn't work for newspapers and so on because they need to read it beforehand. So they locked them up. They couldn't talk about it.
We've seen sort of mini lockups for some big complex announcements
in
the
past.
Well,
there was one year.
Like for the National Energy Guarantee, there was one. I think there was one in relation to
the Henry
NBN,
Tax Review.
So the basic, just before you go further, just the basic principle though is fairly simple, isn't it? It's like, here is a very complex document with a lot of details that needs some explaining, and we're going to release it at this time, but we're prepared to give you a look at it and answer some questions about it first so that when you do report it, you have a
Because otherwise you report it badly. If you have to, particularly now or on radio in early days, if you have to at 7:30 say what's in it and you've only just seen it at 7:30, you're going to do a bad job.
Yeah.
1 year Treasurer
or
Karen.
Or an unfavourable job, which is their biggest fear.
That's right. 1 year Karen was the Treasurer, 91.
Mm-hmm.
I think
John
it was
Karen,
91,
yeah.
John Karen. He decided that this budget lockup was all, you know, just designed to make it look important. And it moved on from beer and cigs. It became the dollar. So is it going to influence the dollar, you know, the size of the deficit and so on? But he decided that was all silly. The dollar was going to move where it was anyway. So he just one afternoon, you know, he said, it's budget afternoon. Anyone who wants the documents can just pick them up from pigeonholes. There are boxes in the press gallery in Parliament House. And he had a protest. He had a delegation of journalists who went to him and said, we demand a lockup. So because, you know, that they were to face that difficulty of needing to, you know, accurately report to people. And so he introduced a mini lockup.
And to do so, and so that you could do a conscientious job of it without being completely scooped by someone who isn't. You know what I mean? Because that's what could happen. I mean, you're sitting there trying to understand it, trying to understand its projections in relation to unemployment or growth or whatever it might be, and someone else has just found something on page 122 and just sort of...
What it's become is an open book exam, exactly like those exams. I did a public service entrance exam at the Wavell Hall at the Adelaide Showgrounds, and rows and rows and rows of people, and they're given like 2 hours to go through this, basically their sort of aptitude intelligence tests. And you're all sort of frightened, and you're particularly frightened if someone gets up to leave the room because you think that person's either really dumb
or really
clever. And that's actually how it is in the lockup, because you get worried when someone gets up. So it's like an open book exam because you're allowed to take in reference materials, previous budgets. You're allowed to cheat. You're allowed to talk to
competitors.
You're
allowed to talk to each other. Yeah.
Although
and a bit of that goes
we're
on.
Often a bit too busy to do that.
That's right.
And you are terrified because by 7:30, the newspapers basically press print on everything that's there. If you don't have it ready by then, it needs to be ready earlier. Someone needs to edit it.
Put it on the page and so forth.
It was 1 year. I told them in advance what the articles would be, and it was 5:30. And so I don't think I'll do that second one. They said, no, you've got to. We've drawn the cartoon.
Yes,
inside baseball, as you say, what's in the budget is more important.
And I've had a few of them say to me, I hope you mentioned such and such. And I say, why the heck? Because that's the photo accompanying the piece. And if you haven't mentioned the finance minister, you've got to get the finance minister in the copy. But I think, Jenny, you haven't had this particular experience, but the real fear for – it's a real sort of downside risk, I think, for the journos, because – it is this big wad of documents. There's, you know, several books and lots of detail in there. And so that when I say downside risk, the risk is that you will miss something. There's a relatively low likelihood that you're going to find something that no one else finds. It has happened. But, you know, like, and particularly if there's a big accounting error in there or an assumption that's just absolutely cockamamie or whatever. But it's the stress of the day, I think, is that you are, as Peter intimated, you're very time poor. You don't really have a lot of time to confer with anyone, and you've got to get across a lot of information. And the downside risk is that you might miss something that's really key out of your coverage, especially if you're, you know, one of the really senior corros and it's actually important that you cover it. That's the risk.
Yeah, that would be a major risk, actually.
Mm.
Last budget, you know, so much of it was telegraphed beforehand. So you wonder how much is left for discovery in the actual lockup. So really you're looking for the bit that hasn't been
that's true.
And truly telegraphed beforehand. And I can imagine that could be quite challenging.
That's true. And that's a really interesting point because in a way that's a kind of a perverse outcome of it, that you almost have people sort of going through it with a fine-tooth comb trying to find that thing that might be an unfavourable thing to the government that hasn't been announced and sort of making more of it than maybe it would ordinarily be made of because all the other stuff's been reported 2 or 3 or 5 days before the budget's come out.
I try and get an idea of I don't so much look for measures because it's more another reporter who does that.
Yeah.
Oh, hello, Mark.
No,
in,
well,
in earlier days, right?
Well, I didn't do measures either, really. I mean, I would sort of look at the overall philosophy of the thing.
But. So I sort of try and look at the financial shape of things. There's a particularly good graph we put in. The financial shape is that the budget position changes, maybe because of the iron ore price, maybe because the economy is good. There aren't as many people on unemployment benefits. More of them are paying tax.
We call these parameter changes, right?
That's what they call them. And then you've got to look at what the budget does after that. There's a helpful table that does that. We turn it into a graph. If you look at the last budget and most of those that went before it, look at the budget in March, Josh Frydenberg's pre-election budget. He had a whole lot of extra money came in. We had high commodity prices then, at least they were high for the time, unemployment falling. So he had, you know, had a lot of money to play with. And he spent about a half of it. So $40 billion coming in over 4 years, he spent about a half of it on all sorts of things, including subsidising the price of petrol and things like that. This budget is very unusual in that hardly any of that has been spent. $52 billion has come in over the four-year period that they look at. They've spent, what is it, $9 billion of that, $9.8 billion. But of that, most of it, $7 billion, was measures to do with the floods, emergency measures, right? So, in a sense, what they've decided to do, and Chalmers on Wednesday, the Treasurer gave an address at the press club where he said,
"This is the post-budget address,
the traditional address, where he said that his people can't think of a previous budget which has actually given away so little of what's come in." Now, the reason he did that is because, it's because of Liz Truss, I guess.
Because I've made myself,
What they're doing in the UK is they're raising interest rates, the central bank, Bank of England, hugely. And if you work against that and the Reserve Bank here is determined to do it to stop people spending, they're just going to do it more. And conscious of that, I suppose terrified really of not wanting inflation to come down, not wanting to add to it, not wanting to make the Reserve Bank's job harder. He's had to, yes, he's implemented every election promise, tick, 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 paid for them by removing coalition measures in the, most of them haven't started yet. They're announced in March. But beyond that, the things that should be done, the things that he would like to do, increasing job seeker, helping people with enormous increases in the price of electricity and gas, he's just unable to do. And that's what he said.
That's right.
I think that's a really sensible way of going about doing things because the hardest thing to do is turn off the tap. You know, so you saw the
easiest
pressure.
Time to do it, though.
Well, it is, but,
just
then,
after an election.
Then you know it's hard to turn it off later. And so already you've had, you know, being pushed to reverse the going back on the petrol excise, being pushed to sort of maintain the low income tax.
Yeah, so they kept that cut on the excise,
so
didn't they?
They kept those in there as cost saving measures because if you look in the outer years, things get really ugly in the budget. So this is an unusual budget, and normally you kind of push stuff to the future. And they've left the tax cuts in there, which means that, you know, the budget in the future is looking grimmer. And so that's actually one of the key stories in this is like, if you get a windfall, bank it. don't spend it.
Yeah.
And particularly don't spend it in a time of inflation. So I'm entirely in agreement with you there. But I think one of the really interesting things for me is always, what are Treasury putting in there as assumptions about the rate of growth in the future? And what's that going to look like? And how quickly do they think inflation's going to come down?
And
they were pretty depressed. So, you know, they've got 1.5% for 2023 in terms of
the rate of
economic growth.
Yeah, yeah.
And the fact that they've not got real wage growth built in until
that's 3.5% down. Yeah, so 3.5% growth currently down to 1.5% growth next year based on all of these external volatilities.
That's right.
It's dangerously close
to stalling. To that word that starts with an R.
It is, yeah. And and that's quite interesting, because this budget cuts in a number of different directions. We have, for example, a better than halved deficit announced in this, largely due to commodity prices, which is really war dividends in many ways. Also higher employment. We've got very low unemployment, 3.5%. And that's led, of course, to better receipts for the government in terms of income tax, personal taxes. And so that's the budget itself looking quite good, but the economy outside of the budget, into which the budget operates, is sort of heading in the other direction. We may even have a situation, I've heard this point made, we may even have a situation where the budget deficit is wiped out completely. Someone told me that with roughly every 3 months of commodity prices at their current rate, that's another $10 billion in extra revenue coming into the coffers. Now, that would pretty much account for the 36.9% projected deficit.
But on the other hand,
you've got interest rates going up,
right?
Yeah.
And so you've still got a service. And so the fastest growing item in the budget is actually the interest payments on the debt. So as long as interest rates keep going up, that gets worse and worse.
Jenny,
part of that is the term structure of our borrowing. So the extent to which it's sort of long dated, which means the interest rate, they don't have to turn it over quickly.
Right.
But you have a lot of debt still coming due, and they have to roll that over
fixed
in the market.
Fixed rates, low rates expire and are replaced by high rates.
That's right. And so when they have to go to the market to borrow again to roll over the existing debt, they have to pay higher interest rates on it. And so it's that term structure of the debt that matters as well. And this is sort of depth of analysis the Treasury has to kind of keep going into.
Jenny, Mark raised a point, and I think you can settle it for me. We have these two things that make no sense when taken together. One is, we're talking about getting near a recession, the economy stalling. After all, that's what's happening overseas. And yet at the same time, people are spending like never before. And, right at the moment, anyone statistically, depends on the individual and where you are and so on, but statistically, anyone who wants a job can get one, because there are about as many vacancies as people. In one sense, the economy has never been better. It's never been more full throttle that I can remember. In the other sense, people are talking about a recession. Can you make sense of this as a former government chief economist?
Well, it actually is, one of these tricky ones, and it's all to do with expectations, right? So people think things are going to get worse. So it's a make hay while the sun shines.
I was wondering whether I was going to hear 5 minutes of economic sunshine. You remember John Howard's?
Yeah, that idea,
last chance.
A lot of people couldn't spend during the COVID lockdowns.
Yeah.
And so, they couldn't spend, transport was clogged up. There were bottlenecks. You couldn't buy new cars because there's a chip shortage internationally. Transport costs were higher. You couldn't actually even import the stuff, and now you can again, though cars are slowly coming online. And so you've got this sort of built up demand. But if people have, and this is what's so dangerous that the central bank is really worried about, is if you have expectations of higher inflation, you might decide to spend your savings now before the prices go up further.
I don't think that's happening yet, do you?
I think there is this, whether it's a bring forward of spending or spending the surplus that people have generated. Because remember, household savings went up through the roof, right? Household savings are now down again, right? But they're spending that pent-up savings. So the question is, has their inflation, are they expecting prices to go up faster in the future? So instead of sort of holding off, I think people are feeling confident about keeping their jobs.
All right, well,
it's an interesting question.
It is an interesting question, and we will go further into it in just a moment. We'll take a quick break and be back directly.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Hi, I'm Sharon Bessel. Policy Forum Pod is the podcast for those who want to dig a little deeper into the policy challenges facing Australia and its region. Each week, we bring together expert analysis to tackle the big issues facing our region and to propose policy solutions. It's insightful, it's positive, and it's always fun. Policy Forum Pod is out every Friday. You can find it on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you get your pods. Or find us at policyforum.net/podcasts.
Welcome back. Now, let's go back to that point you were raising, Jenny, about the habits of people, pent-up demand, what the sort of psychology of consumers. Because Peter had a perplexed look on his face when I was talking, when I was kind of raising this twin track situation. And
yeah, so I wanted Jenny to sort it out. These things do not seem to make sense. A recession mentality or fear on one hand, and people spending like you wouldn't believe on the other.
Yeah. But is it a temporal mismatch in the sense that we actually do have just 5 minutes of economic sunshine for reasons that you were talking about, and because the situation in the world could get worse, and we see these projections for for lower growth, for unemployment to tick up, that the inflationary genie is out of the bottle, or it feels like it is, and governments all around the place are putting a lot into trying to tame this inflation. So that means, grinding the economy down, bringing it, slowing it right down, perhaps not into recession ideally, but who knows? I mean, it's such an inexact science because of all these different moving parts and, as you say, psychology as well.
Yeah, and that's the challenge for economics, is that expectations really matter. And so trying to understand what people are expecting in the future, and do they feel that there's job insecurity, in which case that they save more, but they might be feeling now quite secure in their jobs because unemployment's been so low. Mm. People's, we economists build models around rational expectations, but guess what? The expectations aren't generally rational, so a lot of our models don't work very well because we get that wrong. And so I think this is a temporal thing. I am very worried about that 1.5% because I think
The 1.5%
growth rate projections for the Treasury.
It's
saying commodity prices are going to drop. That's going to be a big part of it because remember, this is GDP.
No, but can I just stop you there, because that's an interesting point. Is it the case that, Treasury is always counselling that we shouldn't rely on high commodity prices. We should
One day it'll be right. Every budget it says that. So to come down.
Yeah, that's right. But nonetheless, the sort of argument is that it's prudent to rely on the long-term average price for these things rather than these demand spikes. And we certainly see, reasons for the commodity price spike at the moment, the Ukraine war in particular. Is that part of that 1.5%?
It's the IMF has downgraded all their growth forecasts. They've been chasing them down at each period for quite some time.
Right.
So they're expecting this big bounce after COVID and lockdowns were over. Well, one, China continues to lock down.
Yes.
And so China's growth is still much, much lower than expected. It is an engine of growth, like the way the US is an engine of growth. And so you can sort of see that, when the US slows because of aggressive monetary policy tightening in the US, even though there's still quite a lot of stimulatory spending going on in the US, that then you get contagion. So other countries start slowing down. Europe is not looking very healthy at all because they're facing massive rise in energy prices this winter and potentially higher energy prices next winter. They think it's actually going to be worse next year. So it's going to be a while before Europe kind of is seen to boom. And so you've got the IMF putting growth down in 2023 to 2.7, but they've got a 25% chance of a sub 2% global growth rate.
Mm.
That's regarded as a recession, isn't it? A worldwide
pretty
recession
much worldwide,
is regarded
yeah.
sub 2% is
well, it means some people are going backwards pretty fast because you've got some just with population growth that are ticking
and
on.
If you're trying to think of the reasons why this would happen internationally, different countries are different. It's largely because, certainly in the case of the countries we compare ourselves with, they're pushing up interest rates in order to try and tame inflation. And yeah. China's got slowing its economy for different reasons.
Yeah, they've also got demographic challenges. So they've got aging populations and so their workforces aren't growing nearly as fast as they were growing before. So that's on the labor side. They've got the reallocation. They've got budget deficit and debt problems. So
sort of overhangs
you know,
from all
so
of the spending.
So you've got all the overhangs yeah. from all the spending that need to be unwound. They're facing higher interest rates as well because they've got to service those debts. And then there's
natural
the issues
disasters.
Around in the natural disasters, big costs of those. And then in the emerging markets, particularly some of the lower income developing economies are facing almost unsustainable debt burdens. And so in that increasing share of those countries are moving into the potential for debt default. And we don't see international cooperation plans on resolving those problems. Those things are highly disruptive. And we know that food insecurity leads to, you know, political insecurity. And the call on the developed economies for Ukraine's reconstruction, just for the war in Ukraine.
The
for,
open-ended
you know,
war.
You look
Ukraine,
at
yeah.
Sri Lanka, the crisis it's in, you know, and there's only so much that those multilateral institutions can do to raise money. And so you can sort of see the calls on the developed economies to try and stop crises happening elsewhere. And it's in our interest to do so because, you know, when countries have – you know, major political crises, the flows of refugees go up dramatically. And
yeah,
so
good point.
The US is a bit more isolated from that, but Europe is really vulnerable to that. And quite frankly, Australia is pretty vulnerable to it too. So there's, you know, so there's lots of different factors that are going to come into play that really worry the IMF and the World Bank and worry us. And so there's scope for lots of downside because we don't act to support places. And we know that, you know, internal civil strife and the like completely undermines growth in those countries.
Is this government, you might have had a chance to look at this part of the budget because it's your key interest. Has this government shown its concern for supporting less developed countries, Pacific countries and Asian countries in a way that wasn't the case earlier?
Well, there's been a substantial expansion, I think, in the budget for the Pacific and also for the Asian countries. Australia some time ago sort of pulled out of really doing much in the way of development assistance in Africa. So our focus is very much within our region. And, you know, Australia needs to react not just in official development assistance. It needs to react in terms of market opening. There's some interesting developments on the Pacific labour market, providing opportunities, which is a win-win, right?
Yeah.
So we need the workers and they need the jobs. So
yeah.
That one's a win-win.
And the economic integration is great for stability and great for, you know, predictability in terms of the region. Yeah.
There's a whole bunch of good things, but there's also risks there too, which is, you know, countries like Samoa are getting worried about losing their prime age people who they need there to be. So, you know, nothing's ever straightforward. This is the challenge. Budgets, you know, budget highlights are really just the beginning of the, you know, they're sort of like the overarching framework. And then it's, you go through the budget documents and the really interesting things in them are all those, you know, like charts and, you know, once you get into the details of things, that's what starts getting really interesting in them. And I haven't had a chance to crawl through it yet, so
Chalmers,
I don't know what's there.
Chalmers at the press club used the term, and I think it was unfortunate, Mark, he used this term because the last person who used it was Tony Abbott. He said, the adults are in charge.
Well, it's not the first time. I thought you might be about to reference that. That he's actually used that a number of times. And in fact, he said it in the press conference in the lockup yesterday. He said it was among the best, you know, most favourable things that, you know, could be said. He was very flattered by the suggestion.
Yeah.
And I think Michelle Grattan, your colleague at the conversation, has pointed out that perhaps this might be better dropped because, yes, that was something that the Abbott government used to say a lot of. But look, I want to come to Chalmers, actually. I'm glad you raised him because it is a new treasurer. It is a new government. It is a a second budget in within the year, which is, you know, an odd thing. And it is a budget very much of its own character, as I think we've all discussed. And, you know, certainly not a big spending budget. It's a budget that is constrained. And I wanted to raise it in the context of something that's mentioned in his speech, which where he makes the point that we're on the cusp of a third global downturn in a decade, roughly, or a dozen years, whatever it is, since 2008. It's a bit more than a dozen years. And I thought about that. I thought about that in political terms as well as economic terms, right? Because when Wayne Swan and Kevin Rudd were confronted by the GFC, Rudd had just won an election declaring himself to be a greater fiscal conservative than John Howard, which was, you know, took a bit of chutzpah, but he did it. He had won. And they were going to run a very disciplined program. The idea was they were moving back into surplus and all of this kind of thing. And then the GFC happens, right?
Global financial crisis.
Yes, known as the Great Recession
in the rest of the world.
Yeah, and so the advice that came to him from Treasury was, you know, stimulate, go hard, go early, go households, and start doing it quickly. You've got to gird the economy against, you know, these headwinds coming from the rest of the world. And while we might say that was a bit inconvenient for what they'd said they would do, it was the right policy at the right time, and they had the capacity to do it, and they did it. It wasn't, while it might have been different from what they said they were going to do, it wasn't going to make them immediately unpopular. No politician minds handing someone a check. Scroll forward then to the next one, which is essentially the big COVID crash, and the same thing happens, right?
The same advice they took just after they'd said they'd get the budget back black. Same department.
Exactly. They got the
same
mugs.
Same people.
Yeah.
They took it.
That's right. And they've got the mugs, you know, the back in black mugs. Everything's predicated on this idea we're about to deliver surpluses after Labor's.
Abandon it.
Yeah. And they had to spend, and they put in more than $300 billion into the economy. Really extraordinary stimulus, some of it more effective than others, but that's always the case. Then we get to this one, right? And we have very dire circumstances that we've just been talking about. And Chalmers doesn't have that confluence of what would be politically popular with what would be economically effective in terms of salvaging the economy, because to spend now, which is what people have become very used to through the pandemic in particular, you know, the idea of the government stepping in and giving them direct relief, to do that now adds to inflation. So he's of the three of them, he's in this situation where he has to show discipline right at the moment when the people the Labor Party traditionally represents are among the hardest hit by the downturn. I just wondered.
Well, he has an escape card. You're right. That's the box he's put in.
Yeah.
He can't, and hasn't spent more. Now, this might change it might change in a heartbeat. It might be that the economy really is at risk of turning down, and then he'll need to spend, and the Reserve Bank will need to cut interest rates. But at the moment, he's in that box, can't spend. The budget, in my many decades of covering budgets, I've never seen one that explicitly factors in a retail electricity price and quotes it, or a retail gas price. They deliberately put those forecasts in, 20% electricity price rise this year, followed by 30%, which through the mathematics of compounding adds up to 56%.
And there is some suggestion today at that press, at that lunch, that it may even be an underestimate.
Because it's an average. So they put that in to scare people, and he's said, look, I can do nothing about this right now. I'm going to look at doing something about it. In that case, there'll be regulatory means. He doesn't want to spell out what they are. But there's something else he can do, and this is when he refers to the conversation with the Australian people. Yeah, sure, he can't increase net spending, but what he can do is increase tax. Now, basically what he has said is, we got a lot of needs. You know, hopefully we can sort out the national disability insurance scheme so it doesn't increase quite as fast. And there's an inquiry, with people living with disabilities actually running the inquiry that's going to deal with that. But that's going to increase in price. We're going to pay aged care workers more. We've said we are, as soon as the Fair Work Commission says. There's the results of a separate disability royal commission. There are all sorts of demands on the budget, increasing Newstart, which is now once again, insanely low. So, or I think they call it job seeker now. So there's all sorts of demands on the budget. And he said, I want a conversation about how we can do the things we will want to do. And he's got a year, he's got 2 years before the election. And I think what he wants to come out of that is, look, we've got all these demands. I'm sorry, I can't meet them. But if we increase another tax, probably won't be the GST. It's a bit difficult.
And it goes to the states and all that.
Yeah, it's a bit difficult to do that. But there are all sorts of other, there are taxes on superannuation. There are all sorts of things that could be adjusted. That way I can help you. And he's almost setting up this, as he says, honest conversation with the Australian people saying, you want more? Support me in providing more. Otherwise, I won't be able to. Mm. Let's talk about what you want. It's pretty good.
I think it is about time that we start having open conversations about the 2% gap between what we think we want to pay in taxes and what we think we want to spend on.
What is it, American style tax system and Scandinavian style demands?
Yeah. And it's a very interesting one. You know, they said, oh, well, the Australian, I think, recently did a survey and said, well, you know, people would rather reduce expenditure than increase taxes. But always reduce somebody else's expenditure, expenditure that they benefit from.
No, don't touch my franking credits.
Yeah, that's right. You know, well, that's a tax thing rather than an expenditure thing, but you've got that there. Yeah.
The disability thing has happened because it cuts completely across that usual someone else. Anyone could be made disabled or their child could be disabled at any minute. There's no way of insurance. It's an insurance scheme. No way of insuring yourself against that. But generally, yeah, we like to say, oh, well, you know, don't support job seekers because I won't be unemployed.
Yeah. And it's one of the problems. So universal schemes of that nature that everybody benefits from are much more popular. But we means test. Australia's unusual in means testing so many of the benefits that we have. And it's that intersect with the means tested schemes and the tax system that I think is where this government needs to go to kind of look at that intersect so that they're sort of saying, well, you know, it's not so much why was this, you know, the statutory tax cuts with a very large 30%, you know, sort of from I think 49,000 up to 180,000 to, you know, there is progressivity, but the progressivity is on the payment side. Right. So it's when does your child, what does your childcare benefit do relative to your family income? What do your family payments do relative to your family income for people who are on a mix of income and, you know, subsidies of some other form, you know, sort of transfer payments, you know, how do they phase out as your income goes up? I mean, pensioners, one of the big issues there is that, you know, they won't work more than a certain amount because, you know, their pensions,
you lose your pension.
You start losing, you know, 50 cents in the dollar of your pension.
The government had a measure in the budget to help with that, but for 2 years only. But,
it's a very high marginal tax rate, right? But is a flat rate on the tax side the right way to go about, you know, sort of getting rid of those very high effective marginal tax rates?
I think, by the way, I think that stage three tax cut that you're describing, I don't think that's done and dusted. I think that will be part of the conversation he wants to have.
I think it has to be.
Well, he explicitly made it so.
Yes.
But having said, like,
the Prime Minister almost said, oh, well, not now, just keep quiet about it.
But that's my point in a sense, though, right? So the thing kind of squalls up as an idea in the weeks before this budget was delivered and then is kind of deflated, right? And word goes out that there won't be anything in this budget in relation to rolling back stage three. But it was definitively not definitively closed off, if I can put it like that. It wasn't like suddenly ruled out. No, that's you know, LAW law, to quote
it
a previous.
Only ruled out for this budget.
Yeah. Now, having said that, I think if you look at the political arithmetic, it's extraordinarily hard to imagine Anthony Albanese agreeing to changing this stage three tax cut, I think. You know, my reading of him is that he's very awake to the sort of the trust issue that was associated with the last election, the idea of governments, you know, sticking to their promises and not just doing something which would be sort of highly predictable in a way, you know, just sort of getting past the election and then changing everything. That said, there may be other ways in which this can be addressed. Now, one of them, and it seems to be like a sort of a third rail in Australian politics, and yet it has been used. And the last time it was used by the other side of politics, and I'm thinking of the 2014 budget, which introduced a temporary deficit levy. Now, that's a progressive way of clawing back some of that money. Could they look at some mechanism like that, for example? A temporary budget repair mechanism.
Well, part of the statutory tax cuts is also the higher than the 180 ones, right? But, you know, first of all, I don't like calling everything a levy because if you are also a foreigner and you pay taxes, they don't consider levies taxes, and so you get taxed on the income that you paid on your levy, so in under some tax regime. So, you know, calling things levy is a tax. Call it a tax. You know,
John Howard
had so many levies. He had a milk levy.
Oh, that's right. Levy, yeah.
I know.
Just be honest about it. Call them a tax.
They're even building levies now. But no, yeah.
And some of them are just proportional. You know, so they're not. The rate doesn't rise as the income rises.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
But what you've got to do is we do have to do something about bracket creep. Particularly when you got nominal wages going up much higher, big faster, but real wages going backwards, right? And so, you know, something about giving back bracket
creep. So in other words, you creep into the next income
bracket,
and you get taxed at that level, your purchasing power hasn't gone up.
Yeah, your purchasing power has actually gone down. Yeah.
And what they could do is say, look, stage three, all of it, 200 odd billion of it, all of it. In the budget, spent. No problem. It's there. We're just going to change the design of it.
Exactly.
So we help the people below 100,000.
Yep.
And we don't give people, which is, to say it out loud, it is just unfathomable. So we don't give people on $200,000 $9,000. By the way, which is worth double that to them because of the tax rate, right?
Mm.
So, I mean, okay, we're still spending the money. We're changing it to help people who might need it more. And besides which, how can you possibly defend what's at the top end? Maybe they could do that.
The other thing they need to do is really get into looking at all the sort of the means-tested thresholds and how those means-tested thresholds interact with the progressive tax rate system.
It's so fiddly, though. So much work. It's so fiddly.
But, you know, that's the job of government, isn't it? I mean, you know, the job of government. And you do actually have people in the public service capable of working this stuff out, okay?
Yeah.
And you've just got to use them.
Yeah, this government actually believes in them. I mean, Chalmers was very generous in his praise of Treasury and finance officials and everyone involved in the ERC process. And
Expenditure Review Committee.
Yes. Thank you. Yeah.
Can I make one quick point?
Yes.
Because it's something that nobody in the commentating I've heard of has really mentioned is the indexation of the different payments that we have. And so, you know, it's not called JobSeeker, it's called, what is it?
New Start. It's called JobSeeker now.
It is called JobSeeker. I thought it was gone to JobSeeker. Yeah. So JobSeeker is indexed to CPI, right?
Consumer price index.
CPI. And that's always been the challenge, right? Because wages had been rising faster than CPI. So JobSeeker was shrinking as, you know,
relative to other wages.
Sure. Pensions, on the other hand, have been indexed to wages.
It's actually, they're indexed to the higher of both.
Yeah.
So there you go.
Well. So they're in good shape, right? And so the interesting question will actually be about the consumption bundles of the people who are on JobSeeker or on pensions, and are they actually – so if you have disproportionately buying things that have gone up more in price because low-income people's budgets mean that they spend more on transport and energy and –
They do spend more
on
electricity,
rent,
yeah.
And certainly rent. Hmm. And so the extent to which those are going up faster. So these are the sorts of questions that you can start. We've got the data now. You used to do simple indexing because we didn't have the data to do it cleverly. But we've got data now where you can actually start designing indexes that much better allow people to maintain the purchasing power of a fixed income than we had before in a way that's much more sort of beneficial to those particular groups. It's not as good as, you know, just it doesn't address that is just the whole relativity too low, but at least you start then building in some consistency in terms of cost of living for these people.
That would be a cheap way of doing something and making a nod to people who are on the appallingly low unemployment benefit to have been saying, well, we're starting, you know, from now on, we'll be paying attention to what's likely to be your expenses.
Yeah.
All right. Look, we're getting very close to time, but there's just one.
We could
sort
go
of,
on forever, mate.
We could. And I'm enjoying this, but there is one thing I want to, or a couple of things I want to come to. First, I just want to get a sense of whether you think, how you think Chalmers went. Just a little assessment from both of you in terms of the change in atmosphere. You know, he, as you said, he's talking about a conversation. He said today, I think, that he'd prefer to be blunt rather than polished in his messaging, you know, talk in ways, talk up to people rather than talk down to them. There is, I think, my impression was that he's a very good explainer. You know, he's a storyteller in the kind of Costello and Keating, an economic storyteller. And I think, you know, he's doing it very well. He's a very good communicator. So I'm just interested in your thoughts about how he came across and whether he can make this conversation that he's talking about actually happen.
He's certainly working for people like, well, us, I suppose, in the room, and probably people who are listening to this podcast as well, right? Yes, they'll listen and they'll communicate. The issue is how much he's getting reach beyond that. So is he hitting the Telegraph readers? And are the journalists who are writing in the Telegraph and the like, who are communicating, do they buy in to this or are they going to kind of put a spin on, oh, there he goes again, you know, gloom and doom, mister, and some of the front pages and the, you know, how they always have those wonderful mashup front pages with, you know,
cartoons.
Cartoons and things. I don't know any, I don't think any had him as the Grinch, but, you know, it's kind of the Grinch who stole Christmas.
But in a sense, that's what was quite clever about it. I thought it was a bit of an oil and water budget in this sense, that it's got all of these grim forebodings in it, but Chalmers himself had quite an upbeat sort of delivery and was telling a story about a future Australia that he thinks we can get to if we are prepared to change some of these things and even change the way we do politics. And it didn't have that sort of, you know, quite the doom and gloom that in fact the words that he spoke, at least the words that he spoke in his official speech tabling the budget, suggested. So, you know, I think that's an exercise in pretty effective communication.
Yeah. He's the best communicator, one of the best communicators I've seen.
Which is not bad for someone with a PhD in economics, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, his PhD is actually.
He also studied communication in his first degree.
Right. Yeah. So
maybe there is something in communication. But he's in, of course, the honeymoon period.
Yeah.
Everyone, me, you, we all want to think the best of him. And he's saying, give me time. I'm going to have this conversation. I'm going to work it out what to do. I'll work out what to do about electricity. And, you know, everyone will give him time.
Yeah.
In 2 years' time, we might have a very different judgment of Chalmers because by then he won't merely be holding open the possibility of all of the things he might do. He will have had to actually made decisions. And, you know, they mightn't be decisions that everyone likes. So it's this glorious sort of, you know, when you fall in love with someone, you sort of
let's not get carried away.
You think she or he or whatever, you think, gee, you know, they're really interesting and there's all sorts of possibilities. Eventually you discover, myself excluded, of course, but eventually you discover that, you know, that those things are actually reduced down to one or two specific things and there's no longer the possibility. Right now we've got all sorts of possibilities and I think people are sort of, you know, prepared to extend him the benefit of the doubt for a while.
Yeah, and I think Jenny's point's right. We don't really know how he's resonating beyond the kind of, you know, those people who are quite closely watching politics and economics. That will be something we'll only know over time. But certainly in terms of calmness and clarity, I haven't seen a first budget performance any better than that. And I thought Frydenberg was pretty good, frankly. I thought Frydenberg was a pretty good communicator as well. But, yes, and when I think back to Wayne Swan, for example, who Jim Chalmers was chief of staff for, Swan seemed you could feel the pressure around Swan, but you just don't sort of get that from Chalmers. Perhaps that will hold him in good stead down the track. Now, this is the final thing I'm going to ask you, and we're going to have to be quite quick about it. what does Dutton do now? I mean, like, how does he frame his position now? Does he sort of think about, oh, well, I'm going to be sort of Tony Abbott and oppose everything, or does he keep his powder dry?
He's doing a mixture. After the budget, he's said we'll support certain things, we won't support others. He's saying we would be more generous. And by the way, it's very easy to believe that's true because that's been, you know, the coalition has been much keener to give away money to, support people with energy prices and all sorts of things. Whether he would be... I think he's saying, we support looking at the NDIS. We would have preferred you're more generous. I think it's fairly easy to be him because he can just disagree at the margins without having to do anything. The truth is that no one pays much attention to oppositions just after a government's change.
Yeah, fair point, Jenny.
We'll look at him in 2 years' time, maybe.
I would really like to see, and he signalled this, that to cooperate on things where there is agreement and that there is a reasonably decent-sized band of agreement. And I think just to see that when you look at compared to the US, where the Republicans who will probably win the House are going to oppose everything Biden wants to do because they don't want Biden to be successful. But Biden being successful is Americans benefiting. So it always seems to me really weird that you would have, you know, an opposing party that doesn't care. It's like cut off your nose to spite your face.
It's insane. I mean,
it's nuts.
It's like, and perhaps it proves that the more you wave the flag, the crazier you are. Because
we weren't like that in the COVID crisis or in the global financial crisis.
That's right.
On the whole, the opposition was saying, well, actually they were saying, we'll get out of the way, but they weren't opposing.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
And that bodes well for Australia's future, actually.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think you're right. Well, look, it's been terrific having this discussion post-budget. We've gone longer than we should have. For those of you who have stuck with us all the way, really appreciate it. I'm sure you've enjoyed it like I have. Thanks to Dr. Jenny Gordon and to Peter Martin. That's Democracy Sausage for this week. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
See you next time.
And we'll be back next week, metronomically as usual, back to every week. Sorry about last week. Bye for now.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.